It's the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by Caitlin Glover. Caitlin's with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, really the lead when it comes to natural resources. And that really covers, no pun intended, a lot of ground.
It does. It's a lot of ground, a lot of air, and everything in between. I typically joke that we have soil health to air quality and everything in that sandwich. The wildlife, the livestock, of course, but then all of the other natural resource components that affect the way our producers do business and live their lives.
And as you're describing that, I'm just thinking you described almost every cattleman that has ever participated in the industry, because they've really got to protect every one of them.
They do. You know, our livelihoods, whether we live in the city or we live in these rural areas, our livelihoods are based around these healthy natural resources. We all want to breathe clean air. We all want to know that there are thriving wildlife communities. We all love the fuzzy creatures, right? But we also need high quality protein both to eat, but then also the high quality fiber to clothe ourselves and to construct homes. And so it's sort of that FFA adage that, you know, without agriculture, you'd be hungry, naked, and homeless. And it's true. So when we talk about soil health, when we talk about air quality, and all of the components that it takes in order to have a successful operation, you're really talking about a symbiotic relationship. The things that are necessary to create good scenarios for cattle and sheep producers are also the things that they help create. So it's this really, really nice flow back and forth between the producers who use and cultivate the land and the resources that sustain them as well.
There's been a plan that's been promoted, and that's known as 30 by 30, at least what the industry is still calling it. It's easy to remember 30 by 30. For those who don't know what that is, let's first identify that, and then tell me what you're watching when it comes to 30 by 30.
Sure. So the thumbnail version of 30 by 30 is that this is a proposal by the administration that was laid out in the first days of the Biden presidency. The goal is to conserve 30% of America's lands and waters by the year 2030. So when President Biden signed the executive order, making it so, setting forth that goal, there weren't a lot of details attached. It's important to remember that an executive order is effectively a presidential wish list. And so when we saw the presidential wish list, we knew that we needed to fill in some details. Now, America's cattle and sheep producers, like I said, they're dedicated on a daily basis to the lands and the waters on which they live and produce their livestock, but also those landscapes that have sustained them and their families for generations. And so when the administration is talking about conservation goals on these landscapes, you know, that really starts with our members, with the producers we represent. And so what we don't know so far is what conservation itself is going to mean or where this conservation is going to happen. And so I think the real question is, well, what do we know? We know, after having been in weekly, sometimes daily conversations with the administration during this sort of initial period, we know that there's going to be a task force. And the job of this task force is going to be to figure out what counts. Our priority is to make sure that grazing for cattle and sheep is considered as one of these conservation activities. Not only do our producers keep open spaces open, but they keep them healthy. They keep them resilient. They make sure that they are available for recreation and for all of these other multiple uses. And so when the administration sort of transformed this 30 by 30 proposal into the America the Beautiful campaign, our answer to that is fine. Okay, great. Because our producers are the ones who keep America beautiful. They're the ones who protect these iconic American landscapes that when people think about America, when they think about our greatest experiment and our greatest asset, they think of these landscapes. And so as we move forward through figuring out these details of what counts, where it's going to happen, certainly there are going to be some issues to watch. We want the administration to recognize not only that grazing is good, right, but also that conservation is very different than preservation. Preservation puts lands on a shelf and hopes they stay that way forever, and we know that just doesn't work. But conservation is also not acquisition. You can't buy your way into a conservation success. You can't designate your way into a conservation success through monuments or through wilderness. This has to be conservation as a verb, right, as a commitment, an active commitment to the landscape and to the people who make this country and these countries' landscapes so great. This is going to happen through a lot of conversations with this new task force, and it's going to happen over a long time. But thankfully for producers and thankfully for those landscapes, we're in it for the long haul. There's no new issues here. It's just new packaging.
You mentioned landscapes and kind of working together. I would imagine right now, and I probably should not do this, but I would imagine at this point there are some landowners who are really frustrated because they felt like they were working in a partnership to help preserve something known as a lesser prairie chicken. And I believe we found in the past numbers can be affected by drought. So what's happening right now with the lesser prairie chicken?
Wow, so that's the million-dollar question, or the multi-million-dollar question, as it were. So you're right. We've seen a lot of movement in lesser prairie chicken recently. The administration, after finishing their status review, did propose some protections under the Endangered Species Act for two distinct population segments, one in sort of that northern section in Oklahoma and Kansas and northern Texas, and the other distinct population segment in the southern part of the Texas Panhandle and into New Mexico. And there are two different proposals for levels of protection proposed. Texas and New Mexico are seeing an endangered listing, whereas the northern population is sought to be managed under a 4D rule as a threatened status. So a little bit less, a lower level of protection, but still quite restrictive. When you're talking about this, I mean, truly Herculean, truly historic effort to bring oil and gas companies, to bring ranchers and farmers together with a whole load of people over the last decade and a half to make sure that we avoided this listing. But it wasn't just avoiding the listing, Tony. It was really trying to make sure that these landscapes were open and durable and protected for habitat in a way that wasn't species focused, but it was habitat focused. And so when we see the administration move, especially in a year where we are having record-breaking drought. I mean, and that's not hyperbole. It is record-breaking drought this year in all of these areas. To see the administration move forward with ESA designations at this time is both really disappointing, but undermines the entire voluntary conservation network that we've seen built. You know, people hinged this model of voluntary conservation on lesser prairie chicken and the success of this process. And so to see the administration say that protections are still warranted, that restrictions are still warranted, is really disappointing. You know, for a lot of our producers, they've already enrolled in the voluntary conservation efforts that provides surety for them, for the habitat, and for the birds. But it really is disappointing across the board. What I hope we don't see is a move away from this voluntary engagement in conservation efforts, because this truly is a successful model, even if the numbers bear out as a downward trend this year because of drought. There is ongoing discussion about what the science says about the populations, but there's no question that the investments that have been made over the last 15 years have been anything but good for the habitat. This is an immense a victory, even if we see the Fish and Wildlife Service trying to set it aside at the moment.
Which takes us right into maybe the last one here, and I'll just say wolf.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, whenever we talk about the Endangered Species Act, we often think of these large apex predators, right? Wolves and bears, both in the north and in the southwest. But a lot of this is because of the habitat on public lands. You know, so we go from lesser prairie chicken, where a lot of the habitat is on private lands, and so we're seeing a lot of private landowner involvement in these conservation programs. The same really can't be true for these larger apex predators like the wolf in the Northwest, simply because there's a lot of federal land that's a component there. Now, across the range, we saw the Fish and Wildlife Service last year move forward with the lower 48, effectively a range-wide delisting of the gray wolf. Now, it omitted two populations. First, the Mexican gray wolf in the Southwest, which we continue to work with our affiliates and the service to address. But it also didn't affect the population that was already delisted, that Northern Rocky Mountain DPS in Montana and Wyoming and in Idaho. But so what that means is Oregon and Washington, the other part of Idaho, into the Great Lakes region, all of those places saw the gray wolf delisted and, of course, immediately challenged in litigation. And so PLC, NCBA, and several of our partners have sought to intervene in this gray wolf delisting in support of that rule, support of the administration as they defend that rule. It's good science, it's common sense, and it was good policy. We know that things like that are going to be challenged, but we have to follow the science. We have to follow the law. The law says when the species is recovered, it should be delisted. That's what the community supports. That's what the science supports. But that doesn't mean that it's always an easy process, right? We know that it's going to be an uphill battle. There are three separate cases in the Northern District of California. There are a number of groups who are challenging that delisting. But it really is an important model of support that once we've hit that threshold, once the science says delist, that we support that science and move forward.
She's the lead for natural resources with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Washington, D.C. It's Caitlin Glover on today's Agribusiness Report.